smells very good.
Hi, my name's Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. Hello, my sobriety date's November 18th. I'm actually not cold anymore. I'll take this off. November 18th, 2004. And I have a sponsor and a home group, Midtown Group in Washington, D.C. meets Sunday nights at 7:30. And in Bethesda, Maryland, actually. We're not in D.C. anymore. We've had a few locations, but that's another story. And I'm very grateful. Thank you, Billy, so much for asking me to speak. Billy's been really awesome and come up and spoken at some of our events. And I love his story. And I think one of the main things I really relate to about Billy's story is, and when he talks about this, the part about how he used to live, like, down by, like, in the woods, and you and your wife at the time had kind of a reclusive lifestyle, and that was what I loved. I mean, I just wanted to be alone with my boyfriend and the bourbon and some other things that have nothing to do with AA, but those were fine too. And that to me was heaven, but not really. It wasn't really heaven, and there was such a heavy price to pay for that. But the first time I grew up in Maryland in a small town called Kensington, and I was adopted, and my parents are German immigrants, and they're just as nice as they could be. I didn't know that until about a year ago, but they are probably, I'm so lucky, and I'm very grateful. One of the things I'm most grateful about being sober is that I'm awake to see that now, and because I really didn't know. I had some inclinations that my parents were good folks, but I couldn't really think about anybody else long enough to form any kind of real impression. It was really just, how are you affecting me? And then that's how I could kind of decipher what you were about. And But the first time I got drunk, I was 9, and it's a very, like a Polaroid flash of a memory, but I was at a friend's house, and she had a babysitter. Her parents traveled a lot, and they would have babysitters for several days. But they'd always be like these either young 20s, you know, year olds or older teenagers, and they would party a little bit always. And I remember getting really drunk with this teenager and her boyfriend. And the only thing I can remember about it is I was wearing a T-shirt with a sparkly decal on it, and they were throwing me in the shower, and I was 9, and I was hammered. And I don't remember ever drinking again or getting drunk again until I was about 13. And then I went to, like, my first big drinking party, and it was the end of junior high, and it was that summer before high school, and I ended up just hammered. And I just remember they had to carry me. Somehow I was in the woods off some bike path, and people had to carry me back to the party. And I remember something, I thought of this the other day, and some of the, like, stream of consciousness memories I have about drinking, I hope you relate to, because some of them are kind of weird, but maybe you'll relate. I remember whenever people would carry me a lot when I was drunk. Like, I'd be too drunk to walk, or often I'd be, and I don't like to bring up other things in drinking except for if I have to, but sometimes I would do a bong hit when I was drinking and get very nauseous, and I would throw up on myself, and then there would really be a need for carrying me away from things. And I always remember that feeling where you were, like, too drunk to talk, but you could still hear what everyone was saying about you, and you knew that everyone was kind of concerned. And I loved that, like, that feeling of I guess it just seemed like you were in a code red situation or something, and people were pampering you. But really, you were just wasted and a total burden. But it didn't seem like it at the time, and I loved that. And but that kind of stuff happened a lot. And in high school drinking, one of the things I remember, and we were talking about this in the car, and these girls that I came up with, my good friends, and we, the three of us got sober together, we were all very, very wild. Like, there wasn't a lack of partying and bar going. We didn't become isolated loner drinkers for a long, long time. I mean, I partied. But I remember that feeling of waking up, like, you're partying and, you know, you're kind of, like, going in and out of blackout, or at least for me, that's how it was. And I'm not there, but then I'm there again. Sometimes I would have the gift of throwing up and being able to sort of come back to life a little bit near the end. And and that was always kind of good, like, you know, because you knew that maybe you'd be able to walk around a bit again and maybe talk some more. And but that feeling of waking up and it's morning and the party's over and there you are. And then I had this pattern of doing that, and so people kind of talked about it, like, man, Stephanie, we couldn't wake you up at the party again. And at the time in high school, that stuff was kind of funny, but things started to happen. And when I look back on it, and there were some things that happened that were that the details of which I don't even think are something I would share from the podium tonight, and it just doesn't seem like it would be appropriate. But some very shameful things that I would hear about and have no memory of, and some of them I wouldn't even allow myself to believe. I would actually live in delusion for a long time that an entire community of people were lying about me. And that there's no way I did that. And I never really could understand why they would form such an alliance against me, but now I know that those things probably did happen. I'm grateful I can't remember them, but I'm sure that they did happen. And then, you know, high school was just, for me, high school was just a party. I'm sure a lot of you guys were that way. I hung out with, I was friends with a couple people in every different kind of group. I was friends with potheads. I was friends with metalheads, which is heavy metal people. You guys probably seem like you would know about that crew. And then there was, like, the thespians, like the people that were, like, in the theater that I even was friends with them. And that was a tough niche to get into. They were very exclusive. But I even could let a couple of them let me in. And I had this, like, kind of could be charismatic, you know what I mean? But at the same time, very difficult. And that kind of that kind of duality is something I think most alcoholics are familiar with, kind of that idea. And I've heard, if you've ever heard Don Major, Don M, speak, he says it so well when he talks about the alcoholic dilemma is that, like, what do they call it, egomaniac with the inferiority complex. And he says, he would think, I can do anything, but don't you understand, I can't do anything. And that is exactly how I always felt. And then that stuff we hear people talk about, that everyone started in high school with everyone telling me how much potential I had. And I heard someone say the other day that someone saying you have a lot of potential is just a nice way of saying, hey, you're not doing SHIT. And that's very true. That was very true for me. I didn't have much in the way of goals and aspirations. And my parents were from another country, and they had not gone to college. And everybody, I grew up in a pretty affluent county. And so all the kids, when I got out of high school, were going to college. And my parents never even talked to me about college. In fact, I talked to them about college because I felt a little left out when people were filling out their college applications. And it was like a big family camaraderie. And I remember that was always something. The education pushed on the kids where I grew up, I always felt really left out about that because my parents didn't ever talk about that. But right around the end of my senior year, it started to really affect me because that's what everybody was busy doing. They were going around and looking at schools with their parents. And my dad was like, look, we both know you're not going to make it in college. Why don't you just get a job for the government? You know what I mean? And I remember thinking, I can't believe this. Because at one time in my life when I was younger, I was in, I don't know what they call it now, but they call it gifted and talented when I was in, like, elementary school. Like, I would go up into the older grades for reading and math. And, I mean, I was on the right track there in the early years. And somehow in between then and graduating high school, people that loved and cared for me didn't even have any faith that I could make it through college. But I ended up convincing them to let me go, and that would be the beginning of three or four institutions that I would, college institutions, that I would blow through and not you know, get anywhere. But then what happened was, and this was, you know, in my life, one of those turning points. I was at a junior college in Rockville, Maryland. I was 20 at the time. I had been to University of South Carolina, dropped out of there. That was the school I convinced my parents to let me go to. They drove me down there, which was so wild for them. Because, again, remember, they don't know about this, driving kids off to college. They're not familiar with this. My mom's barely speaking English at this point in the game. And so I'm working hard to Americanize them from, like, fifth grade. So I've got myself in the car, packed up like the others. My parents are driving me off to college, kind of like not thinking it's a good idea. But as we're driving down there, that feeling started to come across everybody, that hope that I would be so good at generating it with people, that hope that, and we started feeling it together, and they took me down there, and they moved me into this apartment right on campus with another girl, and my dad, I remember my mom and dad both crying, and they realized, you know, that, wow, their daughter's going to college, and I didn't make it a month, and I was back home. Sorry, guys, I met this guy in a band, and, well, they're playing up here more, so... And that was more important, and then I convinced my parents to let me go to acting school. And begged and begged and begged and promised them that I knew why I wasn't going to do well in college, because I'm meant to act. And they were like it kind of made sense to them, because my personality was a little esoteric, a little off. I was always kind of creative, so that seemed like, huh. And in D.C., you know, they have some good acting conservatories, so I got them to pay for that. And then I went to my first class, and they told us how we were going to have to. The first assignment was to, you had to pick like a show tune that you loved from any Broadway show or musical that you loved, and come back the next class and sing that song, but as your favorite farm animal. And this was an exercise to overcome stage fright. And, I mean, I didn't go back, obviously. There was no chance I was doing that. No chance. But, but anyway, so I'm on this junior college campus now. I've like kind of gone down the. I went to university and then the acting conservatory, and now I'm at the junior college up the street. And then I saw this guy that I had the biggest crush on in high school, and he had moved to Colorado. And when I was graduating high school, that was like, I don't know about you guys, but that was like the cool trend. Like people were like moving to Colorado to, you know, kind of like be outdoors and. You know, everyone was still into the Grateful Dead that I hung out with at that time, and there were some other, like, bands like Widespread Panic and Blues Traveler and all these bands that played around out there in those resorts a lot. And so a lot of people I knew were moving out there, and he was one of them. And I saw him at this junior college. He was home visiting, and we ended up hanging out. And 6 months later, I was living in Steamboat Springs, Colorado with him. And that's where I spent the next 5 years. And that was kind of a hopeful period because I was outside a lot. I got really involved in snowboarding, which I love still. And even though I was concerned about what sort of future this could possibly lead me to, everybody I was with was kind of doing that. And there wasn't a lot of talk about, you know, aspirations and goals outside of, you know, how many times you've been on the mountain this season, and, you know, just like throwing darts, shooting pool, good old, you know, fun like that. That's all anyone did. That's all anyone cared about. And I thought that at the time, I thought that I just loved that lifestyle. If you would have told me then that someday I would be back here, you know, or living back in Maryland and working a corporate job and stuff like that, I would have never believed it, because I thought that I just didn't like a traditional lifestyle. I thought I was like kind of bohemian, kind of, you know, I just wasn't meant for the 9-to-5 grind or following the beaten path. All these like things we make up. But really the deal was I didn't have any goals, any motivation, I didn't want to do anything, and this was an environment that fostered that kind of mentality pretty nicely. So I mean, I lasted out there. Actually, other than sobriety, being in my home group in NAA now, that was the longest place I ever remained, and that's because really hardly anything was asked of me there, and so I made it a lot longer there than I did anywhere else. But eventually there I got recognized for my insanity, which was starting to become a common thread for me, and I just couldn't take the shame anymore. My drinking and the behavior, not just drinking, sober too, because we all know now as alcoholics that just because aren't drunk doesn't mean we don't act completely insane. At least that's my experience. Sometimes I'm in worse shape when I'm sober than when I'm drunk. And I did some things that were embarrassing, and You know, I stole some money from some people I work, you know, that kind of stole some money from an employer I worked for years, eventually caught up to me. He fired me. That was the first, I love that guy. I heard him speak at one of your things, but he always talks about direct hits. But that was like the first direct hit, like the first majorly shameful thing. Like I got taken into this guy Rogers' office, and I'd worked for him in Steamboat there in this small town in Colorado for years, and I'd been stealing from him all along, pilfering money here and there, you know what I mean? Like I would crumple up dinner checks and keep the whole, you know, amount and stuff like that here and there, and but it added up, and I didn't know he was on to me, and I didn't know that for years he loved me so much. And some people are just so good-natured, just in and of themselves, it blows my mind. He loved me so much and was rooting for me so much, even the way I behaved and the insanity and the drinking, just disasters and stuff that I would do. He was rooting for me to just stop doing it, and he was watching for me to just cut it out. Because he knew, he could see that deep down I didn't want to live that way or something. I don't know what he saw, but he saw something. And he let me get away with it for a long time, but it was getting worse, not better. And eventually he pulled me into his office and he said, "Stephanie, you're fired." And this guy was like a family member, I thought. So I was shocked. I was like, "What?" Almost like it felt like a joke, and he was like, "You've been stealing from me for a long time, and if you didn't owe me money for a ski pass, I would have kicked your ass out of here a long time ago." You know, he's like, "I've been watching you." I mean, it was like a tar blanket of shame. It was awful. And he says to get out of here. And it was that first feeling of like, oh my God, you know, the first torched relationship, something you really cared about, just gone. And I was ashamed, and I lived there a couple years longer, knowing that everyone in the town knew that about me, because it was that kind of town. And I got arrested there for shoplifting, and that was another one. It was my boyfriend's birthday. I didn't have any money. I stole him this Woolrich sweater at the Soda Creek Saloon, this like cowboy shop. And I was walking out of there, and the alarm started going off, and I just turned around and said, "I stole something," because I knew it was in my backpack. I had no recourse. It's not like they weren't going to catch me. And one more time, the owner of the place, he took me up in his office. I was hysterically crying. I was already so ashamed. I was a chronic shoplifter for a long time, but I hadn't done it in a while, and I thought I was done with it. And so I felt so much shame. I still remember his name, Russ Overstreet. And he had already called the police, because it happens automatically when that sensor goes off. And by the time I was with him for 20 minutes before the police got there, he was crying. He didn't want me to get arrested. You know, I'd like won him over with my sad story of brokenness. And the cops got there, and he was like, "Please, I don't want her arrested. She's troubled. She didn't mean it." And because I had already told him I'd come in and work for free, and I'd clean his house, and I'll dog sit, and I'm sorry, and my boyfriend, I don't have any money. But they had to arrest me, because it was they couldn't take it back or something. You know what I mean? Like, once that call had been put in, it's like it had to go through its process. So they took me out of the jail, and put me in a holding cell, and they had to call my parents, and so I had to get, like, bailed out. Meanwhile, I'm like, I already am well aware that there's this thing in the paper called the Steamboat Recorder, where every little tiny thing that happens in this small town of, like, 1,000 is recorded. Like, if somebody loses their belt, they write it in there. Like, "Man lost his belt on highway." I mean, it was, like, that boring in that town. So I knew this was going to get written up, and it did. Stephanie Timke arrested for shoplifting, Soda Creek Saloon, and I knew everyone was going to read it because everyone looked in there. That was like the first thing you looked at in the paper was the recorder. And so that was another direct hit in Steamboat. And after that, it was like becoming impossible for me to stay there. But I still had the last thing left, and that was the boyfriend, Bobby, from the junior college that brought me out there. And I had cheated on him. And he found out about it because I was so secretive that I actually would talk to the guy I was cheating on him with on the phone next to Bobby, thinking he was asleep, because I'm brilliant. And he caught me, and he just packed me up and drove me home. And he told my parents when he knocked on the door, "Your daughter's a liar. She's a cheater. Good luck with her. I don't want anything to do with her." And it was just kind of like, well, I guess I'll see if I can't get into University of Maryland, I'm home. And that was another, and so that whole episode, in fact, when I wrote my first fourth step in sobriety, Steamboat Springs was on my fourth step, the town of Steamboat, because I was just so, you know, I had so much baggage with regard to that town, because I'd done so many, I mean, I can't even tell you how many people, you know, it's hard for me to not bring up drugs, because they're a part of my story. I don't, because I believe so strongly in primary purpose, but every once in a while, so I apologize if it offends anyone, but there was a lot of, like, good people that didn't party like I partied that I really persuaded into becoming a partier of my ilk. They really didn't want to. And, like, I would get people to do coke when they'd never even done it before. And you know, give them that gift of a night of shame and waking up in that hell of the birds chirping. And it wasn't even their idea. And they were like, didn't even want to do that. And they have kids, you know, because I always hung out with older people, which I don't even know what that's about. But, and so I just felt so badly about that. But I would continue that kind of behavior here. And I'll kind of fast forward because, okay, I have some time and I want to actually talk about sobriety. But I did manage to come back here, go to University of Maryland, which was another hopeful period because I did well in college. Don't know why. Doesn't make any sense. I shouldn't have no explanation for why I did well. It was just some kind of weird miracle. But I did well in college and was bartending through college. And I had this job at this place called Louis in Bethesda, and this job meant everything to me. It was like this, I love music, I'm really into music, and it was this, and I watched this place from a distance, and I was like, I'm going to bartend in there. Because it was like, for Bethesda, Maryland, which is a very conservative area, it was like really cool. Like they had candles lit, and they had jazz bands come in, and you know, it was like not your typical sort of Bethesda bar. It wasn't like a sports bar or something. And I ended up getting a job there bartending, and the people that owned it were super cool, which made sense because they had this concept, so I knew they were going to be cool people, you know, and they were. And I became very close to them, and they became like parents to me and really rooted for me. And I think in my drinking story, what was the hardest thing for me in sobriety, which I guess is common, is that shame of that stream, that like ticker tape of all those people that really rooted for us, that like seemed to go out of their way to help us for no apparent reason, that we let down. And I remember I could never, looking back in the beginning, I never understood why there was such a pattern of people that did that. Like, what was that? Now, when I was drinking, I thought, it's obviously because I'm unique and special and some sort of chosen, I don't know what. I just thought I was almost like not human. I remember I went for like a year and I really thought that somebody, like I was just going to get discovered and taken to like Hollywood or something because I just was so, I don't even know. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Like that. But anyways, I worked there for years and I was getting worse and worse with my drinking. And I had reached that phase of my drinking, and there was a lot of drugs also at the time, which is the only reason I could drink the way I did and keep a bar. But that place, it was like all my friends would come in on Friday and Saturday nights, and that's what I did for about 3.5 years all through college. Every Friday and Saturday night, pretty much, unless I was out of town, was at Louis. My friends would come in there. I would drink, you know, I would start drinking around 10 o'clock. I totally had fun. It wasn't like work. I would make a few hundred bucks. It was like the greatest show on earth as far as I was concerned. I would make all my money for the month in one weekend. Louie and Nancy, who owned the place, were like parents to me. I could do no wrong in their eyes, or so I thought. But little by little, just like at the cantina and Steamboat, they were seeing things and they were watching me, and I had no idea. And my drinking was causing me to make a lot of mistakes that I wasn't even aware of, you know what I mean, and treat people so cruelly and not even know I was doing it. And people, of course people were noticing this. And the cocktail waitresses that would regularly go to the owners crying because I was so mean to them. And I'm not even aware of it. I have no idea I'm behaving like this for the most part. I just think that they're really, really annoying and kind of incapable, and who wouldn't be annoyed by them? You know what I mean? And but they were struggling and they were talking about it. People that were coming in to the bar were asking for their money back because I was mean to them, mainly because I was mean to them. You know, if somebody was bothering me, I would give them their check and just kind of say, you're done. You're cut off, and think that I was getting away with that. Like, who did I think I was? I don't know. I'm like, you know, this 20, at the time, I think I'm 27, in college, like, no one's looking at me like I'm a big deal, except for me. In fact, I remember one of the guys that worked with Louis, the owner, who was older, he's like a contractor, a builder of some sort, and he's helping Louis with some other projects, and I was setting the bar up, and I'm, you know, I think I'm almost 28 now at this point in the game, and I'm, like, thinking I'm somebody, as usual, and he asked me, didn't I want to do anything with my life? And I was like, what? I mean, I remember I couldn't believe it, but, and that was, like, one of those things, like, I would have to drink at that immediately, because I couldn't stand that thought, because I knew that was right, and I couldn't sit with it for more than, like, 5 minutes. And that's what started to happen. The conditions of my life became so unsuitable to me that I couldn't be sober anymore for even a short period of time, because I couldn't, my reality was too unbearable. And the way I treated my parents, I mean, there's so many things that, you know, that I didn't talk about that I did with regards to stealing from them. And I will tell you this one quick story just to, NIH, the National Institute of Health, is near where I grew up. And they have in there these catalogs where you can go in and you can, like, pick out an experiment that you'll be a guinea pig for and get paid for it, which is a little weird. But they have to have humans to test things on that are willing to do it in order to get, you know, to do research. So I went in there and I signed up for one to get money. This was on one of my, I was home from Colorado for a little while, trying to earn some more money, like, during the off season when it was slow there for a couple months. So I did this thing for a disorder called neuropathological pain. And what they needed me for was to come in, and they would inject my arm with this, what they call a capsaicin, which was chili pepper extract. They would inject it into my arm, and it would give my arm the sensation of having that disorder, this neuropathological pain, which is a skin disorder. People that have it, their skin is, like, on fire, and they go insane because they can't put clothes on, they can't work, they can't leave the house. Eventually they go crazy, and unfortunately most of them actually commit suicide. It's a very small, uncommon disorder. So that they wanted to find a cure for it. So they would give my arm the sensation. In the other arm, they would put an IV, and they would put different pain medications and all kinds of different stuff in there. And then they would do different things to my arm, and I would have to point on a pain scale to how much it hurt, right? That's a little weird, don't you think? For several hours, I loved it because I didn't know what they were giving me, but it was like one rush followed by another rush, you know. And I remember the people in there were perplexed at how much I enjoyed this. For most people, this would be like they would dread it, you know what I mean? But anyways, my parents fronted me the money for this, of course. The old, front me the money, I'll sign the check over to you when I get it. And they did that, and when the check came, they were on vacation. I went to their house, I stole the check, I cashed it, and I went to Colorado, like, while they were gone. And I just did that kind of stuff, and just devastated them all the time. And I was starting to have this portfolio of shame that was like a catalog that was just filing through my mind all the time. And nearing the end of that Louis situation, it was getting pretty bad, and my drinking was getting pretty bad, and I was starting to drink. I was starting to have the vodka in my room, in my closet, behind my sweaters, and kind of that feeling like, oh, this isn't normal. People are not doing this, but I'm all right. You know what I mean? Like, it was creeping in like that, and it was getting worse and worse, and then Louis and Nancy fired me. And that was another, just like in Colorado, that was another 3.5 years I worked for them. They came to, you know, Christmas with me, and they had to fire me because of my drinking behavior. And I was in college, my last semester of college. It was summertime. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do for money. I would make my money in one weekend. So now I had no idea what was going to happen. So I just went back to the beach. I was like, forget it. I'm out of here. Back to the beach, bartending. I got 2 months of summer left. I can make some money there. Got into all kinds of trouble there. I mean, I was poaching crabs with this guy. He had a boat, 80 crab pots in the bay in the morning, cash and carry operation, and I bartended at night. I mean, I just was weird. I just lived weird and crazy, and I got out of school, and then for 3 years I worked in a corporate job, and that was a very stagnant, unbearable, lonely drinking phase where I went to work every day and drank alone every night, and would be embarrassed on Mondays at 30 years old at the time, or 29, I'm not even 30 at the time, that I drink alone every night. I don't go anywhere on the weekends because I now don't talk to anybody anymore because I'm too ashamed to be friends with anybody. All the people I grew up with, nobody would I talk to or be friends with. I didn't want them to ask me any questions. I didn't want to talk about the past. I didn't want to be reminded of how I got fired and then banned from Louis for the way I would act, that I came in there and attacked one of the bartenders in a drunken blackout rage because he still worked there and I didn't and had to be banned. I just didn't want any of that to be brought up, so I just stayed alone in my parents' house where I lived. I'd move back in with them and drank every night. And when I would get back to work on Mondays, the people I worked with, I would make things up that I did on the weekend because I didn't want them to feel sorry for me. And I would pretend that I did stuff, and it was bad. And eventually I got this boyfriend again that lived in a trailer in the woods at the beach. And let me tell you something. His lifestyle appealed to me. He was very reclusive. He had motorcycles and skateboards, and the only thing he would do socially is go to concerts. Like, he would go to a lot of cool shows, and then that's it. And he just drank in that trailer, and I liked to drink there with him. And things started to get a little weird when I was working this corporate job during the day, and then on the weekends I'm going to hang out with my pot farmer, trailer, reclusive boyfriend at the beach, where we just drink Jack Daniels and do 8 balls of coke, and that's it, and watch Trading Spaces all weekend. And then I go back to work, and I'm in a Monday morning sales meeting, and here I am back in Bethesda, Maryland, in the hustle and bustle of corporate life, and everyone's in their fresh, crisp suits, and they're talking about, you know, their investments and, you know, their IRAs and how this is happening and that's happening. And they're, you know, they're part of this, like, they're going, somebody's running a triathlon maybe, and another person's, you know, going to start training to summit Mount Everest or something amazing. And I'm just sitting there like, oh, my God, I am not like these people. They have goals, aspirations. They, like, work out. They, like, are concerned about their health. Stuff like that, and it started to get really, really, really unbearable. Then the boyfriend from the trailer even broke up with me. He was like, Stephanie, I don't know what's wrong with you, but this is not, I don't think, where you belong, and I think you got to get some help. And that's what started happening. People started telling me that I needed help. I don't know why no one said AA yet, but no one talked to me about my drinking yet, which was, I still don't understand. I had 3 DWIs. You know, I was drunk all the time. I don't know. Doesn't make sense. But still, people were talking to me a lot about getting into a psych ward or something because I was really getting crazy. And so this guy broke up with me, and I went insane. I mean, insane. I quit my job, this job that I had for 3 years at this software company where I did really well despite my reclusive, lonely drinking, except for the weekends with Eric in the trailer. And I just quit. And again, I had to lie because people were like, where are you going? And I didn't want them to, I couldn't tell them that I was going to move to the beach to bartend so that maybe my boyfriend would fall back in love with me and take me back. That was my plan that I came up with. And that's what, and I went through with it. I moved to the beach, got a townhouse, started bartending. I moved in a mile down the road from this guy in the trailer who wanted nothing to do with me at this point because I had already been stalking him for a while, showing up on the weekends, driving around drunk. I mean, and then he would be, I'd drive all the way down there, follow him around drunk while he tried to, like, ditch me. And then I would find myself drinking alone in the parking lot of, like, a liquor store or a gas station for a while and then driving back to Maryland drunk as hell. I've already had 3 DWIs. I could care less. And I didn't last very long living like that down there until I really couldn't stop drinking. I mean, I was moments away from that anyway, but I went and I bought several bottles of liquor. I remember, you know, what some of them were, but I remember it was 4 or 5 liter bottles, and I just stopped going to work. My roommate stopped coming home, and I was just trying to drink myself to death. And I don't know how it didn't happen, but somehow there was an intervention. I don't remember any of this. Somebody called my parents. They came and got me, had a formal intervention, brought me home to Maryland. Pastor from the church is there, family. Everyone's telling me I got to quit drinking or I'm going to die. I pull together all my resources and give them one last ditch damage control effort to explain that I'm not alcoholic and to please give me another chance. And even though the last decade's been a disaster, this is the wake-up call I need. I'm going to get my life together. I'll come back. You know, this whole thing, and my dad's bawling. I mean, this guy is tortured at this point. I mean, he can't take it anymore. And I kind of convince them, I think to myself, and I go to bed in their house, and I wake up in the middle of the night in the DTs, and I got a drink, and so I find the liquor in their shed, and I drink myself into a blackout there, and my mom wakes me up in her shed in the morning, and at that point in the game, I really felt like my life was in jeopardy. I mean, the look on her face is unforgettable. You know, that is just not where you want to find your daughter, drunk in your shed next to the lawnmower. And I went to my first AA meeting that night, and I got a message of hope the first time I went to AA. I did not stay sober. It took me a year and a half of continuing to try it my way before I actually got an honest sobriety date, but I did go to a meeting every single day, and I believe I got a message in spite of myself and because of God. And even though I wasn't always really sober, I am so grateful that I went to a meeting every day because I believe it kept me alive. And eventually when I had had enough pain and enough failing miserably with my own self-reliance, I finally, with God's help, I found myself at my sponsor's house telling her that I hadn't been sober this whole time and getting another 24-hour chip and doing what we hopefully do, get honest and try again. And that's what I did. And so it's been 3.5 years since then, and sobriety in that time frame has been unbelievably painful at times, unbelievably painful, but I have had such an amazing experience so far. I mean, I look back at the last 3.5 years and some of the things that I've been able to walk through and the people I've met in AA. I mean, I have met some unbelievable people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been so fortunate to hear amazing speakers like Billy and Don M. and Johnny H. and Karen G. I mean, like Sharon. I mean, and these people with these messages, and from all of them I get these little sound bites that I've been able to store away and that I've been somehow blessed to be able to hold on to. And, you know, people like Jeannie, who... this woman's been sober for a long time, and she comes and does our women's weekend. I had come and done our women's weekend a few years in a row, I called her one day, and I said, Jeannie, you know, this was about 8 months ago when I was in what Valerie coined my own dark night of the soul, and I told her, I'm going to kill myself. No one believes me. My sponsor told me to go to the psych ward. The pastor at the church has got me praying more. I don't know what to do. I'm pretty sure I'm going to kill myself. And now my sponsor this was something my sponsor didn't want to hear about anymore. My sponsor had told me, look, dude, if you're really going to kill yourself, you need to go to the psych ward. Because people do it. And I don't want your blood on my conscience. And so I called this woman, and I've always had a connection with her. And she said, I'm at the genie, I'm going to kill myself. And she said, oh, Stephanie, you're so histrionic. She said, you don't have to say you're going to kill yourself. You can just say you're very upset. And I don't know why, but that got in, and I was like, okay. And I stopped saying I was going to kill myself from that day. I have not told someone I was going to kill myself since. Have I had thoughts about it when the chips were done? Is it still like that back door? Probably. But I've never said it out loud since then. And I didn't know that that was an option. You know what I mean? That you could just act better than you felt, and that that was okay. You know, I just had all these old ideas, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, and something that was what happened to me probably about 8 months ago is that I became, after a little while of running on my own steam, you know, having both my fingers crossed in AA that I could get that emotional security that I needed to be okay, and just getting way off the beam. I became unsponsorable because my sponsor did what I believe now is one of the most loving things you can do for someone in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she let me go. She told me she couldn't help me anymore and that I needed help and that I better find someone I would listen to. And she'd sponsored me since my first day in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was a direct hit in sobriety, and that was tough. And she'd walked through 5 sobriety dates with me, 5 or 6 breakups with the same guy. And she let me go, and that's when I met up with Valerie. Some of you might know her. I don't know, in Richmond. And she I'd been talking to her already, and she knew a lot of my story and my struggles, and one of which, probably my biggest struggle in sobriety, has been to what the book tells us is, you know, we cease fighting anything or anyone, and it has been a long road for me to try to cease fighting, and I paid a heavy, heavy price for that too, by the way, and I didn't get away with anything, believe me, and But she sat me down with the big book, and she said, "We're going to go through this thing, and we're going to go through these steps if you want to get better." And I was on board for that because I was, the book talks about, we'd seen it work in others, you know, and we knew that it was possible. I'm paraphrasing. I can't quote the book word for word. I'll probably never be able to, but... You know, that we'd seen it work for others, and that our own, it was clear to us that, like, our own life was just so terrible that, you know, we were ready to try something else. And she gave me this prayer call, and I don't know who they is, but she didn't make it up, somebody did, but the set-aside prayer. And she had me say to God, "Please help me set aside everything I think I know about this book and these 12 steps, and especially about you, and help me have a new experience with this book, these steps, and especially with you, God." And you know, I agreed to put all my old ideas on a shelf and to try to go through the steps with the eyes of a baby. And it was difficult. I'll tell you what, it was really difficult to keep showing up in my home group when you're like me, and a lot of you in here, I'm sure, relate. I don't know why. I'm ashamed of it sometimes, or I haven't in the past, but I'm so concerned with what other people think of me. I just can't even believe it some days. And walking around in there, when people aren't thinking about me, I know they're not, but I think they are, and I can't look up because I've been fired by my sponsor, and you know, I'm just kind of like a pariah around here, but I have to be here because I'm alcoholic, so I better just keep my head down and try to work the steps. And that's kind of the attitude I was doing it with. But guess what? It started to work anyway, even without my permission. And that's what happened. Eventually, miracles happened. And Valerie told me, "Stephanie, I think it's time you go back to your sponsor and you ask her if there's any conditions under which she would sponsor you again." And I did that, and she's Bridget, who started working with me again. And remarkable things have happened. You know, her sponsor died last summer that had been working with her most of her sobriety, and she got a new sponsor, and this woman is amazing. And I've been able to see my own sponsor change, and she's been sharing her inventory with me, and we've been helping each other in that way, and really growing a lot recently. I really don't think that... For me, my experience, had I not hit the skids like I did in sobriety and really been brought to my knees, and another thing that stood out in my mind, all the time I went to a conference where Johnny H. Spoke, and I want to also say, and I know I'm pretty newly sober with my little 3.5 years, but this is what I've seen so far in terms of cultivating a conviction for myself, is that I have a lot of these speakers that I just love their message in AA. I don't know a lot about how they live or what they do outside of that, and I don't really like to engage in if this person does this or that person does that at home, because I've found for me I can get very easily confused if I get into those kinds of talks with people about, so I just know what I hear primarily from the podium. I don't know if that's good, bad, or what, but they got some little sound bites that have saved my life, I believe, so I just take them and go about my life. But Johnny said, when he gave up trying to get anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, he got everywhere. And those kind of little things, and then Sharon, your sponsor, I remember hearing her talk about just dropping the backpack and just moving on without it, like dropping the rock like that, and all these little things, you know, and what happened that was amazing was, instead of in my mind, like I always had that negative tape playing where each like soundbite when I was thinking was very negative, either about myself or you, but it was always something ugly, you know. And what was started happening slowly is it would be like one negative, two positives, one negative. Sometimes I'd have like a whole hour of positive thinking, and I'd be like, wow, you know. And then maybe it might be like a whole day. And this was all the while Bridget's not sponsoring me. The boyfriend that's dumped me 5 times has a new girlfriend right there. I'm seeing them. There they are together. And I'm in the meeting, and I'm all right. And I'm noticing it a little bit here and there, and I'm blown away by it. And it just started to, as I kept taking the actions despite how I felt, simply put, I don't know, that serendipitous thing, just, I don't understand it, but it just started to work. And I got to the, just like people said, you're going to get to the other side of this, Stephanie, and you're going to be so grateful for it one day, and you're not going to trade it for anything. You might never want to go through it again, but you won't trade it for anything. Has become my experience. I don't delude myself, thank God, into thinking that, like, well, that was that, and it's going to be blue skies from here on out. Nor do I, am I living today waiting for the next storm. I do have some idea that I will get crazy again in sobriety, probably, most likely. I'm crazy. But right now I'm living pretty free from the bondage of self, and I'm feeling pretty good throughout the day, better than I have. And I'm like I said, I wasn't always nice here, and I wasn't always a real pleasure to be around, but I believe that I've paid my debt, you know, with regard to that, and so I try not to beat myself up anymore, and I have a right to be a nice person now and to be treated like such, and I don't have to keep feeling like I have some, you know, I have to put my head down because of how I acted, because I do believe that I paid for that, and I just want to give back an AA. My sponsor reminded me this morning that it's supposed to be 90-10, 90%. She said, if you're giving 90% of the day, you can have 10% to yourself and feel okay about it. And I thought, I have to do everything in visuals. I did the pie chart in my mind really quick, and I was like, okay. If as long as I can get that 10%, I can make it. And so I'm very grateful to be here. And Billy, again, thank you so much. And Lynn and Randy and people that I know here, it's good to see you. And my friends, thanks for driving with me, and thank you very much. Thank you.